Hi friends, it's Brittany. Before we dive into today's episode, I have a quick ask for you. I need your help. I'm doing a short listener survey to get to know you a little bit better. Who's tuning in? What do you love? And how I can keep Conscious Pathways fresh, meaningful, and aligned with what you need. It won't take more than 5 minutes, and your feedback means so much to me. It helps me grow and helps this podcast to grow with you. You'll find the link in the show notes, and I would be so grateful if you took a moment to share your thoughts. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now let's get into the episode. Hi, and welcome back to Conscious Pathways, the podcast where we explore the intersection of education and social justice through transformative conversations. I'm your host, Brittany, and I am so excited to share an incredible guest with you today, Mike Brown. Mike is a senior director of community engagement at Cultivate Learning at the University of Washington. He brings a really unique perspective in education, one that challenges the way that we think about learning, identity, and community. And in this episode really highlights that perspective. We really explore this distinction between school and education and the importance of culturally responsive teaching and how we can cultivate learning environments that both affirm and uplift Black and Brown children. Throughout this conversation, we start to unpack how educators can shift away from behaviors that are policing and instead foster classrooms that are rooted in belonging, joy, and play. Mike's insights will really leave you reflecting on the role that we all play in shaping the future of education. So grab your coffee, let's get comfortable, and let's get into it. Mike Brown, thank you so much for joining me.
Always appreciation being in community with y'all.
Yes, yes. Always a pleasure having you here. I always love our interactions. Every time I see him, I'm like, oh, Mike's here. It is so fun to just see you just in community and in space. And I'm just really happy we finally made this happen. It's been months of conversation of like, hey, you should come on the podcast. And so we finally did it. I'm very proud of us. Look at us go in 2025.
Gold star for us, because I'm with it.
Gold star for us, and it's Black History Month. We did it.
Exactly. They're guessing all Black. I'm real. Boy, what is it?
You know, we're for the culture today. Every day, but yeah, especially today. You have a really fascinating background. You've done a lot of different things in a lot of different areas of life. So I want to know, how did you get your start in education and what inspired you to take that dive into education?
Yeah, for sure. I think the easy answer is that my mom had an in-home childcare growing up. And so when everybody else was playing, and you know, I'm 12, everybody else is out in the streets playing. I hear them throwing a football around. My mom was like, boy, get your butt inside and make sure you go warm that bottle up. Right. And so I always was just around childcare. I was always around infants and toddlers. I was always this wild to think. I went back home recently and I ran into one of the children, and now he's like 6'3" standing on top of me. And I'm like, hi, sir. You remember me? I changed your diapers. And so I think that's the easiest answer because I was always around it. But I think the more deeper answer is that when you're part of the African diaspora, my parents are from the Caribbean, Antigua. No, if you want to know how the village is doing, you ask how the child is. And that's always kind of stuck with me. And everywhere I've gone or been or been associated with or been in community with, I've just had this being drawn to working with young children, because I see that young little Black boy working with, I see myself in that. And so even though I was pushed into going into, hey, you know, you immigrants, so you got to go do close deals in China. You got to go get your degree. I went, I did international marketing. I lived in London, I lived in Spain, did all that. But I always just coming back to childcare. I'm home.
Yes, yes, yes. I love that idea of just being home, returning to home. I did a similar thing too, where I was like, I want to be a teacher when I grow up. And people are like, oh, you know, teachers don't make money. Like, don't do that. Go do something that'll make money. And so I was studying all these different things to try to find what felt right to me. And even, you know, I was like, maybe I'll go into medicine. But even in medicine, I was like, I want to work with children. Yeah. And I kind of went to a preschool classroom just as like a stepping stone into the like, next area of the career that I wanted to go into. And just, I was like, I'll do something a little bit different. I've always liked working with kids, always being around kids. So I'll do this for now. And then I'll go get my medical degree and then I'll go to law or med school and I'll do all the things. And my first day in that classroom, I was like, nah, this is it. It's like, nah, this feels home. This feels like it's right. Yes. It's just it's a beautiful, absolutely beautiful feeling. And so you've been in education and you do a lot of trainings within education, especially with other educators. Can you tell us a little bit more about what specifically are you training other educators with?
You name it, I do it. And so I have a plethora of experience a couple great years ago, a couple decades ago, now working with children, whether it's from family child care homes. That was really my start. And then moving into kind of those brick and mortar buildings, those four white walls. So I worked in both informal, formal care, in homes, in group cares, for profits and nonprofits, kind of running the spectrum and running the gamut. And everything that I do is working towards building a more culturally responsive and culturally sustaining and liberatory workforce, right? Educational space, learning space. And so of the trainings that I do, it's on any and everything that's related to race, culture, and identity, and really challenging educators to be not just because everybody say, oh, I'm child-centered, but in what ways are you actually doing? In what ways are you actually thinking about, hey, how am I stepping back myself and not centering myself as the educator because it makes me feel comfortable and being vulnerable? Because we're asking our children all the time in order to be vulnerable. Hey, express your emotions, be vulnerable, do this, do that. But then we don't reciprocate that to them. And so I'm working with a lot of educators, a lot of program leaders, a lot of disability managers, whatever, HR, marketing, because it takes a whole village, like I mentioned earlier, in order to raise this child, in order to think, how do I become more child-friendly?
Yes. And it's something you said just reminded me of a comment that I just heard the other day. I was proposing this to my college students. And, you know, I asked them, what's the purpose of education? Mm. And they had a lot of really great answers, but none of the answers really went too deep. So I kind of kept pressing and kept asking some questions. And someone kind of sheepishly said, like, I feel like you already know the answer. I don't know what answer that you're wanting. And I'm like, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not asking you questions because I know the answer to it. I'm asking it because I want to see your thought process. I want to see what you're considering in your answers. And I want to see where you're coming from. I want to see your perspective. But it just made me think about how even with young children, right, we're kind of training them to see us as these all being, all knowing, omnipotent beings of knowledge, where uh-huh. we just bestow it upon them. And it's like, no, I'm just the people just like you.
Yeah.
I don't know everything. I'm taking it day by day, just like you are. I know some things, but I don't know everything. I don't have the answers to all the world's problems and things. And that's kind of why we are here. And I guess I'll pose that question to you because someone posted it to me and I was like, ooh, this is a fancy question. But what is the purpose of education to you?
I think, well, first we need to understand the difference between school and education. And so school is just a place that we go to gather, right? It could be church. It could be the synagogue, right? But just because you're there doesn't mean the spirit is flowing through you, right? And so the purpose of education, because I often say that I got a PhD. Right? I got a PhD from an academic university. No, right? I got a PhD from the streets. And in that education that the streets taught me was that the streets taught me when I got pushed down, right? And the bully was picking on me and I saw my brothers come through and they had my back. Oh, I understand now community. I understand brotherhood. When we was in the streets and we were trying to figure out, man, how much money we got to get in order to get those. Man, remember those Huggies for 25 cents, man? I'm aging myself. But the Huggies back in the day for 25 cents, you always got the blue one, you got the grape one, right? And it wasn't called grape, it was called purple. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when we put our money together in order to hustle, in order to try to figure that out, that taught me about economics, right? And so I got a PhD, and that's not to discredit anybody who's actually got a PhD through an accredited academic institution, but the education that I got through, and I already forgot the question, so I'm just going, this is what happens when you get somebody from the East Coast on, you know, you just start talking, and you just go, what was the question? But my education is through the streets, and that is what I want for our children. Not necessarily industries to understand that, but to be able to bring life experiences into the learning environments and make meaning out of that, to understand that there is a higher thing going on other than our numbers. I can use my numbers. I can use my letters. I can use the colors. I can use my ability to communicate with one another in order to better this life. Because at the end of the day, it's not about us. It's about how are we working for the humanity of others. And that's what I hope to get through when I'm educating young children.
Yes, getting into that humanity and just seeing people. The original question, which I do think you answered, was, you know, what is the purpose of education? And I think that that is at essence what it is. When someone asked me that, you know, they were like, what is it? I was like, ooh, solid question. And I said something similar that I think it's about community. It's about belonging. It's about finding that space where you authentically are and where you get to belong and be your full self. And that's where we start to share our perspectives. We start to learn more about each other. We start to learn more about our world. And I think I always say working with young children taught me so much about the world, and it taught me so much about other people. Because the work of young children is to really just observe their surroundings and to learn from what's happening around them. That's their work. Their work is meaning making. They're trying to make meaning of what's happening around them. And, you know, they're children, so they do sometimes do that in flawed ways. And so that's where we come in, and we can help provide perspective and guidance and all these different things that we can add to their learning for them to expand that and slowly and surely kind of become this whole holistic being. But yeah, I think that is at the essence what education is, what the purpose and the meaning of education is. It's people, it's community, it's coming together. And I do feel like in a lot of ways we've lost that through our education system. We have definitely lost that. It's become very siloed, very isolated. And of course, living through our current administration, potentially seeing the shutdown of the Department of Education and the impact that that will have on communities and the impact that will have on diverse communities, especially our, you know, students with disabilities, IEPs, students who, you know, are low income, who need these resources in order for them to have some access. The idea is for them to have equal access. We know that that doesn't actually happen in practice, but to still have access. And so it's just concerning, and we see it. And I think we've lost our way in education quite a bit, but that doesn't mean we can't find our way again.
I like to think about it as education is a pathway for re-remembrance. And so as I think about all the things in which our ancestors did and how they didn't have all these technologies, where they didn't have ChatGPT, where they didn't have iPads, where they didn't have all of these things that were like, well, we got to utilize this. You know, it's available to us, so we got to utilize it. Right. And this kind of, I don't know what the exact word is, but like almost, oh, we got to use it. I just think about how they had and relied on their critical thinking skills. They relied on their land-based pedagogy. They relied on the water, on the spirits, on the wind, on all these different things in order to advance civilization much more than maybe I think that we're doing today. And so how are we going back into the things in which ancient civilizations did and how they engaged in math and how they engaged in STEM and how they engage not to the culture, but through the culture in order to educate and to create wonderful things that I can't even fathom today? How do we get back to doing that rather than hand over hand drawing techniques, writing techniques, whatever, right?
Yeah. It's interesting that you kind of bring up how our ancestors approached education, right? It's definitely different than what we have today, because we have a lot more technology. We have a lot more resources at our hands that we didn't have years ago. And in some ways, that is an improvement. And in some ways, it kind of deflects our education and it keeps us back in a lot of ways, because we rely on it far too much, more than we rely on our own brains sometimes. I am guilty of this. I use my Google Maps way too much.
Oh, I can't go nowhere without it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, where is it?
So I was like, oh yeah, I'll tell you the directions. I'm like, please no. No, please. Let the Google do it. So yeah, it takes me so long to try to remember how to get to a place because I just rely on Google Maps. I don't need to remember things, you know, so much. I remember growing up, we had to remember our phone numbers and our address and everything. Like, I remember sitting down with my mom and she's like, this is the phone number. You have to memorize our phone number. This is our address. You have to memorize our address. And nowadays, I don't know my friends' addresses. I just go on the maps and like, oh, there's it. So in some ways, it's having more technology is showing to be a bit more of a hindrance than it really should be. But I think especially what I've been reflecting on, you know, the last couple of weeks since the Trump administration has come into play, and every day there's just something popping up and every day there's something concerning happening. And something I've been reflecting on, and I'd love to get your feedback on that, is this idea of returning back to our grassroots organizing and returning back to our community and being in community with our people and holding each other up in that way. I think similar as we were just saying with education, we've all become very siloed in our own little spaces. And I think that is a form of capitalism and, you know, white supremacy and all the things that there's reasons why these things kind of happen. But the power of community and the power of people and going back to grassroots organizing and how important that is, especially in fighting systemic oppression and especially in uplifting communities. And you kind of have a little background in that too. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So first and foremost, schools and our learning environments are a microcosm of the bigger world, right? And so what we're doing in our learning environments often mimics capitalistic, patriarchal, sexist, a racist world. What white supremacy is doing exactly what it is tended to do. And that is to rip communities of colors apart. It is to scrap over the limited amount of resources that it already gives us. We're infighting. And so in order to dismantle that, we need to push back against the system. We also need to channel, I like to say, our inner toddler and say no. Because if you ever work with a toddler, what do they say half the time? No, 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 no. And so where are we saying no to these things? But sometimes we just like, oh my goodness, we finally got this little bit of piece of money and happiness. You know, we're going to take that and we're going to hoard it and we're going to turn our backs to others rather than opening up our doors and saying, hey, my brother, sister, non-binary royalty from a different race, culture, ideology, why don't you come in? Why don't you break bread with us? And so one thing that I'm re-remembering because I finally went back to my homelands in Antigua 2-3 months ago is that everybody there, right? And man, it's still a third world country, right? They, you know, there's still outhouses and everything like that. There's no Wi-Fi. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody said what's up to everybody. Everyone said blessings, love. It was a shock to my system because even though, you know, you kind of know it, you kind of live it, it's not like how it is when I was in New York, right? And even though I'm in that community, you say hi to everybody, it just hit different. And so what I'm trying now to do and be much more intentional is when I get into that elevator and I'm like, man, I'm having a bad day and I don't want to talk to nobody. Rather than picking up my phone or pretending to text someone, pretending to tweet or do something, I'm actually going to look up, put my phone away and be like, blessings, what's up? How you doing, love? How you doing, queen? Right? And things like that. And so how are we doing that with our children? How are we doing that with all the adults? How are we doing that in our community? Because if we can do these small acts, then we can model it for others. Then we can start to see some of the systemic changes that is needed in order to be sustainable in our lives. And so that's just off the dome, how I think we can get back to grassroots organizing, talking to one another, being in community with one another, being intentional about the time. Because a lot of times I like to think there's no place that we go to play anymore for us as adults, right? And so think about, when's the last time we as adults played? Sometimes I go to the gym first thing in the morning, 5 a.m. and I'm like, man, I don't want to go. This isn't fun anymore. I'm doing it for rehab. I'm doing it for this. I'm doing it for that. And so now I'm trying to change my mindset to be like, man, just have fun with it. I don't need to lift 100,000 pounds anymore because I'm not playing college football anymore. I'm doing this because I'm feeling good within my own body. And so what is that paradigm shift that we're working for? What are we trying to change? What mind shifts are we trying to change to have a more strength-based outlet on this world? So that once again, our brothers, sisters, and non-binary royalties are able to thrive as well.
Yes, the power of a mindset shift is so incredible. I have to remind myself this all the time that, like you said, sometimes you just get in this funk and you're like, man, I don't want to work out. I don't want to eat healthy. Like, I just don't want to. I don't feel like it. It's a lot of work, but you just have to remind yourself like that mindset shift is such a powerful thing that, yeah, I want to feel healthy in my body. Yeah. And if I want to feel healthy in my body, what do I want to do that? I need to move my body a little bit. I need to nourish it with healthy foods. I need to give it rest. If I want to have a healthy body, I know what the steps are to do that. It's not a mystery what I have to do to get there.
And be unapologetically you in that, right? A lot of times we're saying just because things are normal doesn't necessarily mean that it's good. And so if your body is feeling bad, but you're like, man, my body always feels bad, that doesn't also necessarily mean like it should be operating like that. And so we also got to realize that we live in a go, go, go society, especially me coming from the East Coast. Now I'm in the West Coast and man, y'all are slow out here, man. I'm like, all right, we got like a million things to do. Let's go, let's go, let's go. It's okay to rest. It's okay to say no to things. It's okay to prioritize yourself. There's a lot of things happening in this world which are constantly saying, you're not good enough. You're not the best. You're not a baddie. You don't got money. And so it eats at our souls. But how are we also nourishing that? And if that's closing the door, watching some Netflix, eating a tub of ice cream, do you, boo-boo?
Yes, I felt that just finding your pocket of rest and knowing that your rest is a form of resistance and that you've earned this rest, you can do that. Yes, I think my favorite restful practice, I love a good video game. And I always beat myself down all the time. So I'm like, oh, you're playing games and you could be working on X, Y, and Z. But I'm like, no, this is a restful practice for me. I'm turning my, doing a little brain off activity. She needs to turn off for a minute.
Right, because it's always on. For me, I love to color. I just come home and my coloring sheet, right, with my crayons that I might have took from the classroom. We ain't going to talk about that. And I just color. Right. Another thing that I do is I love trying new experiences and adventures. And so I'm doing aerial silks right now. So I'm up in the air and I'm all twisted up. Right. But it's a way for me to challenge myself. It's a way to turn off. And so think about different ways in which we play, like I was talking about. I mean, inviting people in rather than shutting people out. And you don't need 80 million friends, right? That's a fallacy. I used to think about that all the time. But what about the quality of time that you're spending with yourself and with others?
Yes, yes. And this conversation really does melt so easily into that idea of community and belonging. And I'm a big advocate for, like, it's hard for you to do something in the classroom that you're not actively practicing yourself, right? So if I'm going in the classroom kind of touting anti-bias education, but I'm not actually working on that in my own life, the kids are going to know that. It's going to feel disingenuous, right? They're going to know all of these things. And you're going to know it. It's just, there's going to be a disconnect. It's hard to go in the classroom when you're trying to preach something that you are not actively practicing. And if you are wanting your children to be free thinkers and you're wanting them to be creative and you're wanting them to be the change that the world is going to create, you got to start practicing that. You got to practice that in your day-to-day life. And it's going to look different from person to person. It's going to look different context to context. I know we all live very busy lives. And so the idea of like, oh, I don't have time. I don't have money to do this, blah, blah, blah. Rest is free, man. It doesn't have to be expensive. Wow. Rest is free. You could take 10 minutes to close your eyes. Doesn't have to be a nap. Just close your eyes. That's free. That takes 10 minutes.
And it is your birthright, right? For Black and brown people, it is our birthright to rest.
Yes.
And I think about how can we make sure that we're not also, when we do get a little bit of money, a little bit of resources, a little bit of whatever, how are we also not being the colonizers, right? How are we also not being the oppressors? Because of all people, we know how to be oppressed, right? We done that. We got another gold star on that, right? And so how do we not become the oppressed to become an oppressor? And so going back to what you were saying about the anti-bias and how we're living that out ourselves, I think about a couple of different things. I had to post it up and then I moved and I haven't posted it back up. But I think about these statements, my I am statements that I have for myself that I'll share with others in different workshops. And so, for example, I am a male who doesn't need to police how others perform their masculinity. If you are a female, right, I would say, try this. I'm a female who engage in behaviors this society see as exclusive only to masculinity. I am a white person who doesn't need to wound voices of color to feel secure in who I am. I am a voice of color who doesn't need to bruise someone else in an attempt to get closer to the proximity of whiteness. I am a Black person and I don't need to hate or dominate against those with a darker or lighter skin complexion or against multiracial people, right? I work in the United States, but I don't need to reinforce a colonized mindset or only center the Black American experience in my work because, like I said, we come from the diaspora. There is a spectrum of Blackness. And so these are some of their statements that I have, and I have a lot more, but you know, you're going to have to buy my services in order to bring that
one. There you go. Exactly, exactly. Get your money, honey. But that is so powerful. That goes right back into what we were talking about, that mindset shift. And being aware of ourselves and being really reflective, really self-reflective is such a powerful practice, especially as educators. I think we especially need to be very self-reflective and we need to consistently be reflecting on our practices as research comes out. And as we do more observations with children, we learn more about best practices and we learn more about what works and what doesn't work. You know, I think, you know, a conversation that we were just having last night, thinking about, should we be doing hand over hand with children? Should we be doing drawings with children? And that's a practice that's been going on for probably since the inception of education, right? In its inception. But have we really taken time to think about, is this a practice that's actually affirming children? Is this a practice that's actually helping them? Or am I actually hindering their growth and development by continuing this practice? And that only comes by being reflective, and that only comes by asking ourselves these really pointed questions about, is my practice really working for the students that I have in my classroom right now? Because every year you get a new batch of children, or every year, if you go to continuation of care, every year your students and your children are going to be a little bit different, right? That's just the essence of development. They're changing. Their bodies are changing. Their mind is changing. Their brain chemistry is literally changing. So looking at how they develop over time and how we as supportive adults can be the most supportive and helpful in their development and their growth and in their learning. And especially as they are trying to find their own way as they get older and they try to find where their community is, right? In our early years, you know, we're kind of plopped into the community and we kind of go where we're told to go. But as you get older, you start getting more autonomy and finding, where is my community? Who do I feel most comfortable with? Who are my people and where are they? So in previous workshops or articles that you've written, just previous spaces that you've been in, you've talked a little bit about the essence of kindergarten readiness and how this concept doesn't necessarily help children in the same, in the way that we think that it does, right? And I know you and I, as early childhood educators, that's a term that we hear all the time. Like, I want them to be ready for kindergarten. They need to learn the letters for kindergarten readiness. They need to learn this. They need to learn how to write their names for kindergarten readiness. And I think as people who really respect and understand the development of young children, we also understand that the development kind of happens at a different rate than what our standards have set for it, right? So can you tell me a little bit about this idea of kindergarten readiness and how, you know, it doesn't necessarily support the ideas that we might think that it does?
First of all, okay, I see you did your research. Okay, I see. All right. So I was like, well, that's all good. Wait, I said that. Okay, cool. I think we sometimes latch onto these words. And I want to preface this by, there is no, in everything that I've said so far, right? There is no, a lot of times we think about things in terms of black and white, right or wrong, right? But we don't, as educators or as people in general, live in that gray area enough. And so just because I'm saying one thing doesn't mean that's the letter of the law. I'm just here in order to really spark conversation, to challenge you. And if you still go through a reflective process and sit back and go, actually, Mike, I feel really good in the work that I'm doing. Okay, cool. But as long as you're engaging with an open heart, that's all that we want, because that's what we are asking for our children. And so when I talk about kindergarten readiness, I kind of go, why? Because are we only in the business to make sure that they're ready for when they're 5 and 6? Because how I look at it in all the teachings that I had in my culture and teaching through the culture and all these other things is that we were always prepped for lifelong success. That's how it was always framed to me. They didn't care about kindergarten. They didn't care about the third grade. They didn't care about high school. What they wanted, my people, my ancestors, what they wanted for me was to make sure that I was ready to face the world and be unapologetically me, to be able to be courageous enough to stand up in the face of hate, of bias. They wanted me to always remember who I am and where I came from, but also to grow off of that, right? Not just to replicate what they went through and be who they are, but to become my own self, become my own man, become my own person. And so why are we just working to get them ready for the next step when they have 50, 60, 70, 80, hopefully more years to make a positive impact in this world? And so if we are going to change the world, it's got to be up to us. It's got to be early child educators, because we know that we give our children to the K-12 system, no knock on them, but the K-12 system. And we go, oh man, we look at them and we go, the K-12 system are destroying our black and brown boys. And I'm like, are we? Are they? Yes, right? As someone who worked in high schools, someone's worked in middle school, because I started at university, I was like, that ain't it. Nope. High schoolers, and I was like, they're even worse.
I was like,
so kept going smaller and smaller. But we often say that they're killing the souls of our Black and brown children. And yes, that might be true, but we're the first ones who are putting the knife in their back. So they're just killing off what's left of them. But we're doing the most damage in the early years. And I say that because thinking about the Reggio philosophy, right? Children in 100 languages, they have 100 languages, but every single time we tell them, don't say this, don't do that, especially with our Black boys. And my scholarship is really on working with young African-American boys and children from the African diaspora, right? And so that's my thing. I go around the nation, I talk about this all the time. And so we tell our Black boys, children all in general, but I'm specifically as a Black boy myself, who's now a Black man, who still counts and talks to the inner Black boy inside of me to inform my work today. We tell Black boys, no, you cannot do this. You cannot do that. You can't be this. You should do this. You shouldn't be that. They hear no. They hear a litany of no all the time. But where are we telling them yes? We don't tell them, yes, you can be this. Yes, your dreams matter. Yes, you can do this. Yes, you can be that. We say, they come to us and say, I want to be an astronaut. We go, what do we say? Well, you ain't going to be no dang astronaut. Go do something else. And so we're killing the dreams or killing their aspirations from the jump. And so ways that we can support Black boys on the journey towards lifelong success, I think about it through Black agency, right? And so to understand Black agency, we have to frame it within the context of how society views Black bodies. And Black bodies, which includes Black minds, Black spirits, Black gifts, Black culture, has always been controlled by the white man. And so this freedom to determine what's best for oneself is something that has not been fully realized in our society for Black people. Our existence has only ever been viewed in relationship to white people. So in my head, we need to break free of this idea of ownership, break free of it in our ideology, in our culture, in our attitudes, and definitely in our policies, and replace it with the intentional cultivation of Black agents. And we need to actively engage Black children in the decision-making processes of their lives. So that's one way in order to get to lifelong success rather than, oh, hey, good, you can count 1 to 10. I had a child in my class 1 year who was Puerto Rican and Black and spoke Spanish and English. And I had to go to bat all year for this child, as I would have done anyways, but even harder because I had people in management and I had other educators saying, well, this child cannot count to 10, which is a kindergarten ready standard. But I'm like, this child counts to 6 in English, but counts to 15 in Spanish. And so you combine those together, this child is speaking 2 different languages, he's counting more. And so I don't understand why we're saying he's not kindergarten ready. And so now we need to place him in a IEP plan and disrupt the entirety of his educational system because now people are going to look at him through a deficit model. And so that's just one way. Another way that I really want to highlight is Black identity. And so there are so many different things that plays a crucial role, a critical role in understanding our racial identity. There are the personal experiences, our families, our communities, our workplaces, the aging process, in our political and our social events. And so a big part of the construction of Black identity in our educational system that is currently in place and is fitting because we're in Black History Month. But what does it do? It revolves around 2 things, slavery and Martin Luther King Jr. I love me to dream, but you know, there's more than 2 Black people in the world, right? And so depending on what school, what part of the country, the upbringing, so many different factors. Part of the conversation now might also revolve around social movements like Black Lives Matter. But those 3 things, they're all born out of tragedy. What does our curriculum and our lesson plans leave out? That's Black joy. And so a crucial part of Black malehood identity is joy, Black boy joy. But so little of our, and when I think about it, so little of our lives are actually spent in childhood, right? We say childhood ends at like 9. Right? But then we go on to live to be 100. And so because so little of our childhood, and it's even worse for Black and brown boys and girls, right? Due to our identification, due to the over-sexualization of us and our bodies, And so because so little time is actually spent in childhood, don't we owe it as early childhood educators to preserve that in children?
Yeah, that is so powerful. And I think that perspective is so powerful. The joy of Blackness and the joy of especially Black boys and Black girls who deserve to be children and who we know statistically don't often get the space to be allowed to be children. Black children are constantly seen as older than they are. And that's a lot of the work that I did in my master's program, looking at the school to prison pipeline, but specifically looking at the adjudication of youth in adult criminal prisons. Uh-huh. And how this happens, especially to Black and brown children, but also children with disabilities. This happens to them far more often than their white counterparts, even if you look at the sameness for crime, right? The same violent crime or anything like that. And more often, the Black boys are being tried in adult criminal court and not juvenile court, right? And you can have, depending on the state, you can have children as young as 13 years old being tried as adults. And so we see that not only in our legal system, we see that in our educational system, we see that even in early childhood, right? I think people think that, like you said, oh, it's the K through 12, like they're the ones who are doing this, like the early childhood educators, they're fine. Early childhood educators, like preschool teachers, don't see color. How could they possibly be racist? And it's like, are they people? If you're a person, then you have the capacity to be a part of racism and to be a part of systemic oppression, whether you're aware of it or not, right? Oppression is oppression. And oftentimes this does happen. You do see that happening. You know, there's the school to prison pipeline, but also extending to early childhood, the cradle to prison pipeline. So seeing very, very young children, you know, as young as 2 years old, getting suspended and expelled from school multiple times. Again, these children are two. What could a two-year-old possibly be doing that would merit them being expelled from school? Like, let's really think about that.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Like, really think about how we're looking at children and are we actually seeing them as children? Seeing them in their full humanity, right? Like, these are little people and they're here to learn. They're here to grow. Like I said, the work of children is to learn. It is to observe their surroundings. It is to take in information. It is to gain perspective. That's really their job, right?
That's it.
For me, as an early childhood educator, honestly, I could care less if the kid knows their letters by the time they leave, you know, my preschool. I could care less if they can count to 10.
They're going to learn it.
They're going to learn it. Like, unless there's a significant issue there, and if we haven't identified it by that point, then what am I doing? But unless there's a significant learning issue there that we haven't identified, they're going to learn it. You know, they're going to learn it on their own time frame. I want to see you having steps of being a good person. I want to see you practicing empathy. I want to see you with your social emotional skills. I want to see how you interact with other people.
Because they're not teaching in K-12 system.
Not really. No, those are quote unquote soft skills. And those aren't really the most important things. And you see programs like the arts programs getting cut. You see recess getting shorter and shorter and shorter. So kids are spending less time being free. Like recess is that time that is supposed to be unstructured. Children need unstructured time to exist. Even adults, I need unstructured time. We just talked about that, right? I need time to just turn my little brain off and just exist as a little person.
Mm-hmm.
And children especially, that's where a lot of this learning comes from, is when they're able to be creative and they're able to, you know, practice their creativity and to be free and to have time where they're just existing and they're interacting with their peers and they're communicating with their peers. Like that's where a bulk of their learning comes from, is through their play. Is through them interacting with others. Again, that's perspective taking. That's where they're learning those conflict resolution skills. That's where they're learning perspective. That's where they're learning new communication skills. That's where they even start learning things like economics and physics. Like they start learning these things by playing and being in community with other people. And yes, there's some things that you can learn a little bit better with direct instruction. Typically reading, you do need some form of direct instruction to get reading because our brains just don't work that way. Don't get me started on reading. Reading is a whole other thing. That's a whole other podcast. I have my beef with reading. I love reading, but I also have my beef with how we teach reading.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that's where we learn so many things. And it is disheartening to see how much is getting cut from that. And especially when we look at identity, especially when I was going to school, I didn't learn too much about identity development and how our identity develops in culture. Most of the people that we studied are just old dead white dudes who had some good things to say. I'll give it to them. They had some good things to say, but it wasn't until later in college when I started learning more about these diverse pedagogies and Paulo Freire, like started to really get these perspectives in that I started to see education and development from a different light.
Exactly. You know, you did say one thing that piqued my ear, and it was about policing. And a lot of times I've been in a couple of states recently, some very red and rural places, but it was actually in a couple of places that were really liberal that caught my, like, just like, wow, okay, cool. Because, you know, you would expect that in the heart of some of these states, but not necessarily here in quote unquote left-leaning places. And it was a conversation around policing. The conversation that I helped to support, to facilitate, help them realize was that we as educators are actually police officers, but we don't necessarily have that title. And so policing can happen in our educational system, and it absolutely does. And you don't need an actual police officer there to happen. All you need is someone with power who creates rules that allows said group to maintain said power over others. And so I'll ask everyone to think about how many of us have classroom rules, right? I assume all of us have rules. How many of us have crafted those classroom rules together with the children? And then how many of us then revisit it over and over and over again throughout the year? How are we tweaking them? How are we changing them? How are we altering them to have positive outcomes for our children? How many of us are taking the time to explain how a rule was broken? Not even a rule. I would say, what about a community agreement? Revamping it to that. So how many of us are giving the children the chance to repair the relationship first before we go into a punitive measure? And so when we're patrolling children's bodies, behaviors, attitudes, and language, we're no different than a police officer. And so when we send children out of the classroom, think about what message we are sending to them. What's that tiny inner voice telling themselves that they're internalizing, right? They're internalizing that I'm a troublemaker, that I'm bad, that I'm not worthy. And so I ask all of us as educators, as program leaders, as anyone with direct or indirect contact with young children, to really be careful and cognizant of how we engage in classroom policing.
That is such a powerful concept to leave out on because, yeah, in a lot of ways, we become these authority figures in the classroom. And even if we don't particularly see ourselves that way, you're seen as an authority figure, whether that's from families and parents who you don't know their background, you don't know their experience with education. So you don't know if they've had poor interactions with educators in the past and the education system. So you really don't know where they're coming from in that. And knowing that in a lot of ways, you do hold a lot of power, especially when we're thinking about our Black and brown children. And so really being cognizant and reflecting and looking at our practices with these children, like, am I creating a space for them to feel comfortable and safe and themselves and whole? Am I creating a space for them to show up as their whole and true authentic selves? Or am I creating a space where they constantly have to hide that part of themselves where they feel like they're not allowed to show up the way they are? They can't talk the way they talk at home and they can't be the way that they feel the most authentic in being. And we do have a lot of power in that classroom. You have the power to really create a classroom environment that is holistic and is that feels really good in a classroom that students want to be in and want to learn in. Like, you do have that ability and that power. And sometimes it doesn't feel like it because, you know, you have administrators and you have all these other different pressures on top of you telling you that you need to do something a specific kind of way, or you need to act a way, or you need to do everything this very specific way. But I think that's part of why teaching is political. I just talked about this with Dr. Megan Madison recently, but love her. Yeah, teaching is political. I mean, a lot of people want to say keep politics out of schools. It's like, that's not how that works. It is. It's a political thing. And it's really important that as educators, we are continuing to stand up for our students and we're standing up for our communities that we work in and that we're being loud, that we're saying how it is. And we're saying, like, this is not what education stands for. This is not what we believe education look like. I always say, like, especially with politics, we just have to be loud and annoying. The more loud and annoying we are, eventually they'll have to listen to us.
I can do that. I'm good at that. Don't worry.
Right. Let's call your people, show up, just be loud and annoying, keep poking at them on the internet, just like, hey, I don't like this. I don't stand for this. And you shouldn't either. Because that's how we do get change. That's how change happens. And it's hard. And advocacy, you know, I say it all the time on the podcast, but advocacy, it looks different for everyone. So show up in a way that feels authentic to you. So whether that is calling, whether that is showing at the protest, or maybe you're more behind the scenes, you know, maybe you're writing letters, maybe you're helping other people to write letters. Maybe you are really great with your words. So instead of maybe calling, maybe you can help write letters for your friends who might not have that same gift with words. Maybe you're writing letters, maybe you're writing emails. There are so many different ways. You know, your art can be your form of advocacy and activism. You can be bringing awareness. There's so many different ways that you can engage in advocacy and also rest. Rest is also advocacy. So do all the things, all the above. And on that note, tell me, how do you reimagine education?
We're talking about engaging in a paradigm shift so that our frameworks, I'm going to tie it back to Black boys, so that our frameworks can reflect the brilliance of Black boys and all children. And I hone in on Black boys because Black boys has been one of the more scrutinized, attacked, marginalized, discriminated groups in the world. And so if we can focus on Black boys and not at the expense, right? Because we often think, oh, it's at the expense of other children, but we know that if we can uplift, you know, what's the saying? A rising tide lifts all boats, something like that, right? And so if we're able to support Black boys, then our brown girls are be able to be lifted up. Our Latino boys, right? Everyone else gets lifted up with that rising tide. And so we need to engage in a paradigm shift so that our frameworks can reflect the brilliance of Black boys and children. And when we do this, when we engage, when we assess, we are ensuring that we are providing opportunities for it to happen through the various different ways that Black children learn, that Dr. Deborah Sullivan, often quote her, she has a book called The Genius of Black Children, Black Boys, somewhere on my bookshelf. Once again, Dr. Deborah Sullivan, though, that you can, Deborah, Wren, and Anita Sullivan, Cultivating the Genius of Black Boys. I have to do a quick Google search real quick. That's her book. So I think we need to talk about what is a decolonized mindset and re-indigenizing looks like. How can we build authentic relationships with the communities that we're trying to serve? So being an anti-racist organization and community means more than just, hey, we want to serve more families of color. That's like putting a band-aid on the situation, how I look at it. Just because we serve more families of color doesn't mean all of our problems go away. So you can't serve families of color with justice if you don't have the community ready to serve them. And so I think about how we're breaking up cycles of wealth, how we have a lack of Black and brown staff and adults in your programs, right? How we can bring in Black and brown elders and invite them into your program to share stories, to engage, not just in a tokenizing way, but how are you actually giving up control as an educator and allowing them to be part of your program? I think about if you're lacking Native or Indigenous opportunities to engage, how are you making not transactional, but reciprocal relationships with the Indigenous communities, with the land that you're currently sitting on? How are we diversifying our supply chains, right? Agriculture can be a tough business and farmers of color need the same stability that white farmers need. And so how can we give that stability by making long-term contracts directly with the farmers in order to diversify the food in your programs? How are we decentering whiteness and how are we scaffolding in opportunities and institutionalizing more diverse traditions that are reflective of the community that you're serving, right? How are we introducing chopsticks? How are we celebrating Lunar New Year, which we're in the midst of, at least at the time of this recording? How are we providing alternatives to Christmas and Thanksgiving? How are we thinking about fall harvest and Kwanzaa? And so before starting, we really have to have a better understanding of the history of the communities that we're working with and the cultural norms of the communities that we're trying to engage with. So a lifetime commitment to this work, because that's what I think of, not just kindergarten readiness. It's not just a commitment for this year. It's not just a commitment because we got funding for it, but this is a lifetime commitment that we have to make to, once again, our Black boys and to all children. And that means we have to understand the anti-Blackness that's operating within us. And so if you want to support Black boys, it's not just about what you do in your individual learning environment. It's about what your organization is doing and then what the community at large is doing that allows this Black boy to feel, to be visible, to be valued and validated for who that person is. And so I expect everyone to share this podcast. I expect everyone to continue learning about how anti-Blackness shows up, how it shows up and how it affects everything from housing, how it affects everything from healthcare, and understand that how it shows up and what it might look like in your class today, right? Exclusionary discipline and where we say, right, you're no longer welcome here through expulsions and suspensions of our Black males, of our Black females, of Black youth. Hyper surveillance, right? We have metal detectors, cyber surveillance. We're looking for ways in which Black boys are violent, they're disruptive, and otherwise unsettling. We classify Black males as bad through disciplinary actions. We isolate seats. We isolate them from the classroom. We isolate them from participating in the life of the learning environment. We overrepresent them in special education, right? We refer them and we get them arrested by the police figures, or we send them into the principal office. We send them to a counselor. We write them up for bad behavior. And then we create documentation in a cumulative file for them that follows them, right? We ignore white children when they act out, but we punish them. But then we punish Black children for the same behavior. We ignore Black boys when they raise their hand in class, which is another thing, which I'm like, why do we raise hands? But anyways, so all this is to say is that we have to remember that every behavior has a reason. And so if we're going to reimagine our learning environment, we have to remember that also every behavior has a reason. My homeboy, Nick Dromis, talks a lot about on our podcast together. And so it's important to remember this. And before you engage, to really think to yourself, what is this child trying to tell me? Yeah, that's how I imagine reimagining education.
I mean, that feels good to me. That feels like a space I want to be in. And that feels like a space as a student that feels holistic and feels that it would be pouring into me as a student. But it also feels like in a space as an educator that you would be supported, that you would have that space and that time to do your reflective practice and to really understand what practices are working, what practices aren't working, and to make those changes. And it sounds like you would have a community around you that could support you with that, because this work is next to impossible to do alone. It is so hard. It's hard to hold yourself accountable in these types of ways, especially as we're doing this work, and having someone that you trust that can be a thought partner in this with you and to help hold you accountable and to help tell you like, oh, hey, you might want to think more about this, or you're doing some problematic things. You might want to consider like having someone that you know and trust that can have these hard conversations when things aren't working. These are all things that are so incredibly important. And it feels, that would feel good to me. So I know that would feel good to other people too.
And if you get called out, at least from my perspective, you get called out, I'm calling you out for some racist or discriminatory things. I'm not doing this to penalize you. I'm doing this because I got love for you, right? Because there's so many times where someone says something, I just go, I ain't got time for this. And I just keep it pushing because I don't have love for them. And so once again, just that paradigm shift in how do we be receiving this information and from home.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that we don't try to change the things if we don't care about them, right? And I think that goes with a lot of things, that concept of like, oh, if you don't like America, then just leave it. And it's like a lot of the work that we're trying to do is because we do believe in it. We do believe in the power of change and the capacity of being able to make forth change and do that. There's a lot of belief there. And, you know, we wouldn't try to change it if we didn't care in some capacity, you know, like I would have left a long time ago. So like, deuces. But, you know, I care about my people here and I care about the students here who deserve better, right? And I'm willing and able to fight for that, for them to have that better because they deserve it. You know, all students deserve that. Mike, I want to thank you so much for joining me and having this in this beautiful conversation. If my audience is interested in connecting with you, where can they find you?
Oh, man, so many different ways. You can, first and foremost, you can find us on our podcast. And I mentioned earlier, Nikki and Nick Taronis, who I do a podcast with, who's Mexican, indigenous, and he's an infant toddler educator as well. We have a podcast called NAP, K
podcast, one word, like taking a nap in cast, like at the end of podcast.
Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can send us an email at napcast206@gmail.com.
I always got to make sure because I never send myself emails. So I'm like, is that the right one? But yes, that is the right one. napcast206@gmail.com.
And then you can find us on Instagram. We just started Instagram. And look, I'm so social media unsavvy. So I'm like, what is this? How do I post? What's the music button?
And you can find us at napcast206 on Instagram.
Beautiful. And I will link all of that in my show notes below. So if you're curious on connecting with Mike and definitely listen to that podcast, it is great. Again, thank you so much for joining me this conversation. I feel so good. I feel like, all right, we're ready to take on the world now.
That's what we do.
Exactly. Thanks for being a friend of the pod and I appreciate you being here.
For sure. I appreciate you.
Wow. What an incredibly necessary and incredible conversation with Mike, from redefining what education truly means to advocating for systemic change. Mike really does remind us that learning is more than just meeting those academic standards. It's about cultivating identity, joy, and the sense of belonging in all children. As we wrap up, I really want to leave you with this question. How are your practices, whether you're a parent, a teacher, an advocate, how are those practices impacting the lives of children and the ways that we can affirm their identity? Let's continue this conversation in our communities, at the dinner table, with our teachers in the classroom, and really within ourselves as we continue to reflect on our practices in education. If you love this episode, feel free to share it with a friend, colleague, coworker, anyone who you feel like really needs to hear this. Subscribe, like, and share the podcast. It really does help the podcast to grow and find more listeners just like you. And don't forget to follow Mike's work. It's all linked in the show notes. He does really incredible work on social media, so go check that out. And as always, you can find more resources, episodes, and discussions over on my website, Conscious Pathways. You can subscribe to my newsletter, Pathways of Promise. You'll find more resources, books, and guides in that newsletter. So please subscribe to that. And until next time, don't forget to navigate your conscious journey with courage and kindness. And I'll see you there for more transformative conversations.